Chapter 24.
It's a Friday afternoon. Out in the parking lot, the people on first shift are getting into their cars to go home. There's the usual congestion at the gate. I'm in my office, minding my own business, when suddenly, from through the half-open door, something ricochets off the ceiling tiles. I jump to my feet, check myself for wounds, and, finding none, search the carpet for the offending missile. It's a champagne cork. There's laughing outside my door. In the next instant, it seems as though everyone is in my office. There's Stacy, Bob Donovan, who holds the bottle from which the cork came, Ralph, Fran, a couple of the secretaries, and a swarm of other people. Even Lou joins us. Fran hands me one of the styrofoam coffee cups she's dispensing to everyone. Bob fills it from the bottle. What's this all about?
Hey, I'll tell you in the toast I'm going to make as soon as everyone has something to swallow.
More bottles are opened. There's a case of this stuff. And when all the cups are filled, Bob lifts his own.
Okay. Here's to a new plant record in shipments of product. Lou went through the records for us and discovered that until now, the best this place has ever done in a month was 31 orders shipped at a value of about $2 million. This month, we topped that. We shipped 57 customer orders with a value of, well, in round numbers, we'll call it a cool $3 million. Yes. Yeah.
Well, not only did we ship more product, but having just calculated our inventory levels, I am pleased to report that between last month and now, we've had a 12% net decline in work-in-process inventory.
All right.
Well then, let's drink to making money.
Hey.
And we do.
Industrial strength champagne.
Very distinctive. Did you pick this out yourself?
Hey, keep drinking. It gets better.
I'm just about to hazard a second cup when I notice Fran beside me.
Mr. Rogo.
Yeah?
Bill Peach is on the line.
I shake my head, wondering what the hell it's going to be this time. I'll take it at your desk, Fran.
Okay.
I go out there and punch the blinking button on my phone and pick it up. Yeah, Bill, what can I do for you?
I was just talking to Johnny Johns.
I automatically grab a pencil and pull over a pad of paper to take down the particulars on whatever order is causing us grief. I wait for Peach to continue, but he doesn't say anything for a second. What's the problem?
No problem, actually. He was very happy.
Really? What about?
He mentioned you've been coming through for him lately on a lot of late customer orders. Some kind of special effort, I guess.
Well, yes and no. We're doing a few things a little differently now.
Well, whatever. The reason I called is, I know how I'm always on your case when things go wrong, Al, so I just wanted to tell you thanks for me and John's for doing something right.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. You are a truly wonderful person for driving me home, and I meant that truly.
Don't mention it. I'm glad we had something to celebrate.
She shuts off the engine. I look up at my house, which is dark, except for one light. I had the good sense earlier to call my mother and tell her not to hold dinner for me. That was smart, because the celebration continued onward and outward after Peach's call. About half of the original group went to dinner together. Lou and Ralph threw in the towel early. But Donovan, Stacy, and I, along with three or four diehards, went to a bar after we ate and we had a good time. Now it's 1:30 and I am blissfully stinko. The Buick, for safety's sake, is still parked behind the bar. Stacy, who switched to club soda a couple of hours ago, has generously played chauffeur to Bob and me. About 10 minutes ago, we nudged Donovan through his kitchen door, where he stood there bewildered for a moment before bidding us a good evening. If he remembers, Donovan is supposed to enlist his wife later today to drive us over to the bar and retrieve our vehicles. Stacy gets out of the car and comes around and opens my door so I can spill myself onto the driveway. Standing up on uncertain legs, I steady myself against the car.
I've never seen you smile so much.
I've got a lot to smile about.
Wish you could be this happy in staff meetings.
Henceforth, I shall smile continuously through all staff meetings.
Mm-hmm. Come on, I'll make sure you get to the door.
With her hands around my arm to steady me, she guides me up the front walk to the door. How about some coffee?
No, thanks. It's late and I better get home.
Sure?
Absolutely.
I fumble with the keys, find the lock, and the door swings open to a dark living room. I turn to Stacy and extend my hand. Thank you for a wonderful evening. I really had a swell time. Then, as we're shaking hands, I, for some reason, step backwards, trip over the doorstep, and lose all my balance.
Whoa!
Whoa!
The next thing I know, Stacy and I are sprawled on the floor together. Fortunately, or maybe not, as it turns out, Stacy thinks this is colossally funny. She's laughing so hard, tears start to roll down her cheeks, and so I start laughing too. Both of us are rolling on the floor with laughter when the lights come on.
You bastard!
I look up, my eyes adjusting to the sudden light, and there she is. Julie, what are you doing here? Without answering, she is now stomping through the kitchen. As I get to my feet and stagger after her, the door to the garage opens. The light switch in the garage clicks. I see her in silhouette for half a second. Julie, wait a minute! I hear the garage door rumbling open as I attempt to follow her. I go into the garage. She's already getting into her car. The door slams. I zigzag closer, wildly waving my arms. The engine starts.
I sit here waiting for you all night, putting up with your mother for 6 hours, and you come home drunk with some floozy!
But Stacy isn't a floozy! She's...
Accelerating to about 30 miles per hour in reverse, Julie backs out of the garage, down the driveway, narrowly missing Stacy's car, and into the street. I'm left standing there in the light of the garage. The tires of her car chirp upon the asphalt. She's gone. On Saturday morning, I wake up and groan a couple of times. The first groan is from the hangover. The second groan is from the memory of what happened. When I'm able, I get dressed and venture into the kitchen in quest of coffee. My mother is there.
You know your wife was here last night.
I pour my first cup. Then I find out what happened. Julie showed up just after I called here last night. She had driven over on impulse because she'd missed me and she'd wanted to see the kids. She apparently wanted to surprise me, which she did. Later, I call the Barnett's number.
She doesn't want to talk to you anymore.
When I get to the plant on Monday, Fran tells me Stacy has been looking for me since she arrived this morning. I have just settled in behind my desk when Stacy appears at the door.
Hi, can we talk?
Sure, come on in. She seems disturbed about something. She's avoiding my eyes as she sits down. Listen, about Friday night, I'm sorry about what happened when you dropped me off.
It's okay. Did your wife come back?
Well, no, she didn't. She's staying with her parents for a little while.
Was it just because of me?
Nah, we've been having some problems lately.
Al, I still feel kind of responsible. Look, why don't I talk to her?
Nah, you don't have to do that.
Really, I think I ought to talk to her. What's her number?
I finally admit to myself it might be worth a try. So I give the Barnett's number to Stacy. She writes it down and promises to call sometime today. Then she continues to sit there. Was there something else?
I'm afraid there is.
She pauses. So, what is it?
I don't think you're going to like this, but I'm pretty sure about it.
Stacy! What?
The bottlenecks have spread.
What do you mean the bottlenecks have spread? Is there a disease out there or something?
No, what I mean is we have a new bottleneck, or maybe even more than one. I'm not sure yet. Here, let me show you. Look at these computer printouts. These are listings of parts that are queued up at final assembly.
She goes over the lists with me. As always, the bottleneck parts are still in short supply. But lately, there have been shortages of some non-bottleneck parts as well.
Last week, we had a case in which we had to build an order for 200 DBD-50s. Out of 172 different parts, we were missing 17. Only one of them was a red tag part. The rest were green tags. The red part came out of heat treat on Thursday and was ready by Friday morning. But the others are still missing.
I lean back in my chair and pinch the bridge of my nose. Damn it! What the hell is going on out there? I had assumed the parts that have to go through a bottleneck would reach assembly last. Is there a material shortage on those green tag parts? Some kind of vendor problem?
No, I haven't had any problems with purchasing. And none of the parts have any processing by outside contractors. The problem is definitely internal. That's why I really think we have one or more new bottlenecks. Maybe with the increase in throughput, we've loaded the plant to a level that we've run out of capacity on some other resources in addition to heat treat and the NCX-10.
Yes, that sounds like a possibility. With the bottlenecks more productive now, our throughput has gone up and our backlog is declining. But making the bottlenecks more productive has put more demand on the other work centers. If the demand on another work center has gone above 100%, then we've created a new bottleneck.
Does this mean we're going to have to go through the whole process of finding the bottlenecks all over again? Just when it seemed like we were on our way out of this mess. Okay, look, I want you to find out everything you can, exactly which parts, how many, what products are affected, which routings they're on, how often they're missing, all that stuff. Meanwhile, I'm going to try to get hold of Jonah to see what he has to say about this.
After Stacy leaves, and Fran does the calling to locate Jonah, I stand by the window in my office and stare at the lawn while I think. I took it as a good sign that inventory levels had declined after we implemented the new measures to make the bottlenecks more productive. A month ago, we were wading through parts on the non-bottleneck routings. There were piles and piles, and the piles kept growing. But some of the stocks have dwindled over the past couple of weeks of product assembly. Last week, for the first time since I've been at this plant, you could actually walk over to the assembly line without having to turn sideways to squeeze between the stacks and bins of inventory. I thought it was good. But now, this happens.
Mr. Rogo, I've got him on the line.
Jonah? Hi, listen, we've got trouble here.
What's wrong?
After I tell him the symptoms, Jonah asks what we've done since his visit, so I relate all the history to him, putting QC in front of the bottlenecks, training people to give special care to bottleneck parts, activating the three machines to supplement the NCX-10, the new lunch rules, assigning certain people to work only at the bottlenecks, increasing the batch sizes going into heat treat, implementing the new priority system in the plant.
New priority system?
Right. Then I explain about the red tags and green tags and how the system works.
Maybe I'd better come have another look.
I'm at home that night when the phone rings. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
I owe you an apology. I'm sorry about what happened on Friday night. Stacy called me here. Al, I'm really embarrassed. I completely misunderstood.
Yeah, well, it seems to me there is a lot of misunderstanding between us lately.
All I can say is I'm sorry. I drove down thinking you'd be glad to see me.
I would have been if you'd stayed. In fact, if I'd known you were coming, I would have come home after work.
I know I should have called, but I was just in one of those moods.
I guess you shouldn't have waited for me.
I just kept thinking you'd be home any minute, and the whole time your mother kept giving me the evil eye. Finally, she and the kids went to bed, and about an hour later I fell asleep on the sofa and slept until you came in.
Well, you want to be friends again?
Yes, I would. When will I see you?
I suggest we try Friday all over again. She says she can't wait that long. We compromise on Wednesday.
Chapter 25.
Deja vu. At the airport next morning, I again greet Jonah as he walks out of gate 2. By 10 o'clock, we're in the conference room at the plant. Sitting around the table are Lou, Bob, Ralph, and Stacy. Jonah paces in front of us.
Let's start with some basic questions. First of all, have you determined exactly which parts are giving you the problem?
Stacy, who's sitting at the table with a veritable fortress of paper around her and looking as if she's ready for a siege, holds up a list.
Yes, we've identified them. In fact, I spent last night tracking them down and double-checking the data with what's on the floor out there. Turns out the problem covers 30 parts.
Are you sure you released the materials for them?
Oh, yes. No problem there. They've been released according to schedule, but they're not reaching final assembly. They're stuck in front of our new bottleneck.
Wait a minute. How do you know it's really a bottleneck?
Well, since the parts are held up, I just figured it had to be
We jump to conclusions, let's invest half an hour to go into the plant so we can find out what's happening.
So, we parade into the plant, and a few minutes later, we're standing in front of a group of milling machines. Off to one side are big stacks of inventory marked with green tags. Stacy stands there and points out the parts that are needed in final assembly. Most of the missing parts are right there and all bear green tags. Bob calls over the foreman, a hefty guy by the name of Jake, and introduces him to Jonah.
Yeah, all them parts been sitting here for about 2 or 3 weeks or more.
But we need them now. How come they're not being worked on?
You know which ones you want. We'll do them right now. But that goes against them rules you set up in that there priority system. You see over there? They all got red tags. We got to do all of them before we touch the stuff with the green tags. That's what you told us, right?
Uh-huh. It's becoming clear what's been happening.
You mean that while the materials with green tags have been building up, you've been spending all your time on the parts bound for the bottlenecks?
Yeah, well, most of it. Hey, like we only got so many hours in a day, you know what I mean?
How much of your work is on bottleneck parts?
Oh, maybe 75 or 80%. See, everything that goes to heat treater, the NCX-10, has to pass through here first. As long as the red parts keep coming, and they haven't let up one bit since that new system started, we just don't have the time to work on very many of the green tag parts.
There's a moment of silence. I look from the parts to the machines and back to Jake again.
What the hell do we do now? Do we switch tags? Make the missing parts red instead of green?
I guess the only solution is to expedite.
No, actually that is not the solution at all. Because if you resort to expediting now, you'll have to expedite all the time, and the situation will only get worse.
But what else can we do?
First, I want us to look at the bottlenecks because there is another aspect to the problem.
Before we can see the NCX-10, we see the inventory. It's stacked as high as the biggest forklift can reach. It's not just a mountain, but a mountain with many peaks. The piles here are even bigger than before we identified the machine as a bottleneck. And tied to every bin, hanging from every pallet of parts, is a red tag. Somewhere behind it all, its own hugeness obscured from our view, is the NCX-10.
How do we get there from here?
Here, let me show you.
And he leads us through the maze of materials, all work in process, until we reach the machine.
You know, I would guess just from looking at it that you have at least a month or more of work lined up here for this machine. And I bet if we were to heat treat, we would find the same situation. Tell me, do you know why you have such a huge pile of inventory here?
Because everyone ahead of this machine is giving first priority to red parts.
Yes, that's part of the reason. But why is so much inventory coming through the plant to get stuck here? Okay, I see I'm going to have to explain some of the basic relationships between bottlenecks and non-bottlenecks. By the way, do you remember when I told you that a plant in which everyone is working all the time is very inefficient? Now you see exactly what I was talking about.
Jonah walks over to the nearby QC station and takes a piece of chalk the inspectors use to mark defects on the parts they reject. He kneels down to the concrete floor and points to the NCX-10.
Here is your bottleneck. The X, whatever it is, machine. We'll simply call it X.
He writes an X on the floor. Then he gestures to the other machines back down the aisle.
And feeding parts to X are various non-bottleneck machines and workers. Because we designated the bottleneck as X, we'll refer to these non-bottlenecks as Y resources. Now, for the sake of simplicity, let's just consider one non-bottleneck in combination with one bottleneck.
With the chalk, he writes on the floor, Y, arrow, X. Product parts are what join the two in a relationship with each other, Jonah explains, and the arrow obviously indicates the flow of parts from one to the other. He adds that we can consider any non-bottleneck feeding parts to X, because no matter which one we choose, its inventory must be processed at some subsequent point in time by X.
By the definition of a non-bottleneck, we know that Y has extra capacity. Because of its extra capacity, we also know that Y will be faster in filling the demand than X. Let's say both X and Y have 600 hours a month available for production. Because it is a bottleneck, you will need all 600 hours of the X machine to meet demand. But let's say you need only 450 hours a month, or 75% of Y to keep the flow equal to demand. What happens when Y has worked its 450 hours? Do you let it sit idle?
No, we'll find something else for it to do.
But Y has already satisfied market demand.
Well, then we let it get a head start on next month's work.
And if there is nothing for it to work on?
Then we'll have to release more materials.
And that is the problem. Because what happens to those extra hours of production from Y? Well, that inventory has to go somewhere. Y is faster than X, and by keeping Y active, the flow of parts to X must be greater than the flow of parts leaving X, which means...
He walks over to the work-in-process mountain and makes a sweeping gesture.
You end up with all this in front of the X machine. And when you're pushing in more material than the system can convert into throughput, what are you getting?
Excess inventory.
Exactly. But what about another combination? What happens when X is feeding parts to Y?
Jonah writes that on the floor with the chalk. X, arrow, Y.
How much of Y's 600 hours can be used productively here?
Only 450 hours again.
That's right. If Y is depending exclusively upon X to feed it inventory, the maximum number of hours it can work is determined by the output of X. And 600 hours from X equates to 450 hours for Y. After working those hours, Y will be starved for inventory to process, which, by the way, is quite accepted.
Wait a minute. We have bottlenecks feeding non-bottlenecks here in the plant. For instance, whatever leaves the NCX-10 will be processed by a non-bottleneck.
From other non-bottlenecks, you mean? And do you know what happens when you keep Y active that way? Look at these.
He draws a third diagram on the floor with the chalk. Y, arrow, A, and directly underneath, X, arrow, S. And underneath the S, the rest of the letters forming the word assembly. In this case, Jonah explains, some parts do not flow through a bottleneck. Their processing is done only by a non-bottleneck, and the flow is directly from Y to assembly. The other parts do flow through a bottleneck, and they are on the X route to assembly, where they are mated to the Y parts for a finished product. In a real situation, the Y route probably would consist of one non-bottleneck feeding another non-bottleneck, feeding yet another non-bottleneck, and so on to final assembly. The X route might have a series of non-bottlenecks feeding a bottleneck, which in turn feeds a chain of more non-bottlenecks. In our case, Jonah says, we've got a group of non-bottleneck machines downstream from X, which can process parts from either the X or the Y route.
But to keep it simple, I've diagrammed the combination with the fewest number of elements. One X and one Y. No matter how many known bottlenecks are in the system, the result of activating Y just to keep it busy is the same. So let's say you keep both X and Y working continuously for every available hour. How efficient would the system be?
Super efficient.
No, you're wrong. Because what happens when all this inventory from Y reaches final assembly?
Well, we build the orders and ship them.
How can you? 80% of your products require at least one part from a bottleneck. What are you going to substitute for the bottleneck part that hasn't shown up yet?
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
So if we can't assemble, we get piles of inventory again. Only this time, the excess inventory doesn't accumulate in front of a bottleneck. It stacks up in front of final assembly.
Yeah, and another $1 million sits still just to keep the wheels turning.
You see, once more, the non-bottleneck does not determine throughput, even if it works 24 hours a day.
Okay, but what about that 20% of products without any bottleneck parts? We can still get high efficiencies with them.
You think so?
On the floor, he diagrams it like this. Y, arrow, product A, and directly underneath, X, arrow, product B. This time, the X and Y operate independently of one another. They are each filling separate marketing demands.
How much of Y's 600 hours can the system use here?
All of them.
Absolutely not. Sure, at first glance, it looks as if we can use 100% of Y, but think again.
We can only use as much as the market demand can absorb.
Correct. By definition, Y has excess capacity. So if you work Y to the maximum, you once again get excess inventory. And this time you end up not with excess work in process, but with excess finished goods. The constraint here is not in production. The constraint is marketing's ability to sell.
As he says this, I'm thinking to myself about the finished goods we've got crammed into warehouses. At least two-thirds of those inventories are products made entirely with non-bottleneck parts. By running non-bottlenecks for efficiency, we've built inventories far in excess of demand. And what about the remaining third of our finished goods? They have bottleneck parts, but most of those products have been sitting on the shelf now for a couple of years. They're obsolete. Out of 1,500 or so units in stock, we're lucky if we can sell 10 a month. Just about all of the competitive products with bottleneck parts are sold virtually as soon as they come out of final assembly. A few of them sit in the warehouse a day or two before they go to the customer, but due to the backlog, not many. I look at Jonah. To the four diagrams on the floor, he has now added numbers so that together they go, number one, Y arrow X. Number two, X arrow Y. Number three, Y arrow A, and directly underneath, X arrow S, and directly underneath the S, the rest of the letters forming the word assembly. And number four, Y arrow product A, and directly underneath, X arrow product B.
We've examined four linear combinations involving X and Y. Now, of course, we can create endless combinations of X and Y. But the four in front of us are fundamental enough that we don't have to go any further. Because if we use these like building blocks, we can represent any manufacturing situation. We don't have to look at trillions of combinations of X and Y to find what is universally true in all of them. We can generalize the truth simply by identifying what happens in each of these four cases. Can you tell me what you have noticed to be similar in all of them?
In no case does Y ever determine throughput for the system. Whenever it's possible to activate Y above the level of X, doing so results only in excess inventory, not in greater throughput.
Yes, and if we follow that thought to a logical conclusion, we can form a simple rule which will be true in every case. The level of utilization of a non-bottleneck is not determined by its own potential, but by some other constraint in the system.
He points to the NCX10.
A major constraint here in your system is this machine. When you make a non-bottleneck do more work than this machine, you are not increasing productivity. On the contrary, you are doing exactly the opposite. You are creating excess inventory, which is against the goal.
But what are we supposed to do? If we don't keep our people working, we'll have idle time, and idle time will lower our efficiencies.
So what?
Beg pardon, but how the hell can you say that?
Just take a look behind you. Take a look at the monster you've made. It did not create itself. You have created this mountain of inventory with your own decisions. And why? Because of the wrong assumption that you must make the workers produce 100% of the time or else get rid of them to save money.
Well, granted that maybe 100% is unrealistic, we just ask for some acceptable percentage, say 90%.
Why is 90% acceptable? Why not 60% or 25%? The numbers are meaningless unless they are based upon the constraints of the system. With enough raw materials, you can keep one worker busy from now until retirement. But should you do it? Not if you want to make money.
What you're saying is that making an employee work and profiting from that work are two different things.
Yes, and that's a very close approximation of the second rule we can logically derive from the four combinations of X and Y we talked about. Putting it precisely, activating a resource and utilizing a resource are not synonymous.
In both rules, utilizing a resource means making use of the resource in a way that moves the system toward the goal. Activating a resource is like pressing the on switch of a machine. It runs whether or not there is any benefit to be derived from the work it's doing. So, really, activating a non-bottleneck to its maximum is an act of maximum stupidity.
And the implication of these rules is that we must not seek to optimize every resource in the system. A system of local optimums is not an optimum system at all. It is a very inefficient system.
Okay, but how does knowing this help us get the missing parts unstuck at the milling machines and move to final assembly?
Think about the buildup of inventory both here and at your milling machines in terms of these two rules which we just talked about.
I think I see the cause of the problem. We're releasing material faster than the bottlenecks can process it.
Yes, you are sending work onto the floor whenever non-bottlenecks are running out of work to do.
Granted, but the milling machines are a bottleneck.
No, they are not, as evidenced by all this excess inventory behind you. You see, the milling machines are not intrinsically a bottleneck. You have turned them into one. With an increase in throughput, it is possible to create new bottlenecks. But most plants have so much extra capacity that it takes an enormous increase in throughput before this happens. You only had a 20% increase. When I had talked to Alex by phone, I thought it unlikely a new bottleneck had occurred. What happened was that even as throughput increased, you continued loading the plant with inventory as if you expected to keep all your workers fully activated. This increased the load dumped upon the milling machines and pushed them beyond their capacity. The first priority red tag parts were processed, but the green tag parts piled up. So not only did you get excess inventory at the NCX-10 and at heat treat, but due to the volume of bottleneck parts, you clogged the flow of another work center and prevented non-bottleneck parts from reaching assembly.
All right. I see now the error of our ways. Can you tell us what we should do to correct the problem?
I want you all to think about it as we walk back to your conference room, and then we'll talk about what you should do. The solution is fairly simple.
Chapter 26.
Just how simple the solution is doesn't become apparent to me until I'm home that night. I'm sitting at the kitchen table with a pad of paper and a pencil, thinking about what was suggested today when Sharon comes in.
Hi.
Hi. What's up?
Not much. Just wondered what you were doing.
I'm working.
Can I help?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of technical. I think you'd probably be bored by it.
Oh, does that mean you want me to leave?
No, not if you want to stay. Do you want to try to solve a problem?
Okay.
All right. Let me think of how to put this to you. Do you know about the scout hike Dave and I were on?
She doesn't, but I do. Sharon doesn't know anything about the hike, but I can help you.
Son, I think there is a career for you in sales.
Yes, I do know about the hike.
You weren't even there.
I've heard everybody talk about it.
Okay, both of you can work on this. Here's the problem. We've got a line of kids on a hike in the woods. In the middle of the line, we've got Herbie. We've already taken the pack off Herbie's back to help him go faster, but he's still the slowest. Everybody wants to go faster than Herbie. But if that happens, the line will spread out and some of the kids will get lost. For one reason or another, we can't move Herbie from the middle of the line. Now, how do we keep the line from spreading? They both become thoughtful. All right. Now, both of you go into the other room. I'll give you 10 minutes, and then we'll see which one of you comes up with the best idea to keep everyone together in the line.
What does the winner get?
Well, anything within reason.
Anything?
Within reason. So they leave, and I get about 10 minutes of peace and quiet. Then I see the two faces looking around the corner. Ready? They come in and sit down at the kitchen table with me.
Want to hear my idea?
My idea's better.
It is not.
Okay, enough. What's your idea, Sharon?
A drummer.
Pardon me?
You know, like in a parade.
Oh, I know what you mean. There aren't any gaps in a parade. Everybody is marching in step. Sharon beams. Dave gives her a dirty look. So, everybody's marching in step to a beat. Sure, but
How do you keep the people in front of Herbie from setting a faster pace?
You have Herbie beat the drum.
Yeah, that's not bad.
But my idea's better.
Okay, wise guy. What's your idea?
Tie ropes to everyone.
Ropes?
You know, like mountain climbers. You tie everyone together at the waist with one long rope. So that way, no one could get left behind, and nobody could speed up without everybody speeding up.
That's very good.
It would mean that the line, which would translate to the total inventory in the plant, could never be longer than the rope. And the rope, of course, could be of a predetermined length, which means we could control it with precision. Everyone would have to walk at the same speed. I look at Dave, a little in awe of his creativity. Come to think of it, the rope makes it sound like having physical links between all the equipment, which is like an assembly line.
Yeah, an assembly line. Didn't you tell me once that the assembly line is supposed to be the best way to make things?
Well, yes, it's the most efficient way to manufacture. In fact, we use that approach when we do the final assembly for most of our products. The problem is that an assembly line won't work throughout the whole plant. But those are both good ideas you two thought up. In fact, if we changed each of your ideas just a little bit, we'd almost have the solution suggested to us today.
Like how?
See, to keep the line from spreading, it actually wouldn't be necessary to keep everyone marching to exactly the same step or to keep everyone tied to the rope. What we really have to do is just keep the kid at the front of the line from walking faster than Herbie. If we can do that, then everybody will stay together.
So we just have to tie the rope from Herbie to the kid at the front.
Or, maybe, Herbie and the boy at the front of the line will have signals. When the boy in the front goes too fast, Herbie tells him to wait or slow down.
That's right. Both of you figured it out.
So what do we both win?
What do you want? A pizza with everything? A night at the movies? They're quiet for a moment.
The movie sounds good. But what I'd really like is if you could get Mom to come home again.
Now it gets very quiet.
But if you can't, we'll understand.
Well, I'm doing my best. Meanwhile, how about the movies?
After the kids have gone to bed, I sit up wondering for the 100th time whether Julie will come back. Compared with my marital difficulties, the inventory problem at the plant seems simple. Or at least it seems simple now. I guess every problem is easy once you've figured it out.
We are, in effect, going to do what my kids came up with. The Herbies, the bottlenecks, are going to tell us when to let more inventory into the system. Except we're going to use the aid of computers instead of drums and ropes. After we returned to the conference room in the office building today, we started talking. And we all agreed that we're obviously releasing too much material. We don't need 5 or 6 weeks of inventory in front of the bottleneck to keep it productive.
If we can withhold materials for red parts, instead of pushing them out there as soon as the first non-bottleneck has nothing to do, the milling machines will then have time to work on the green parts, and the parts we're missing will reach assembly with no problem.
That's right. What you have to do is find a way to release the material for the red parts according to the rate at which the bottlenecks need material, and strictly at that rate.
Fine, but how do we time each release of material so it arrives at the bottleneck when it's needed?
I'm not sure, but I see what you're worried about. We don't want the opposite problem of no work in front of the bottleneck.
Hell, we got at least a month before that happens, even if we release no more red tags from today on. But I know what you mean. If we idle a bottleneck, we lose throughput.
What we need is some kind of signal to link the bottlenecks with the release of material schedule.
Excuse me, this is just a thought. But maybe we can predict when to release material by some kind of system based on the data we've kept on both the bottlenecks.
What are you getting at?
Well, since we started keeping data on the bottlenecks, I've been noticing I'm able to predict several weeks in advance what each bottleneck will be working on at a particular time. See, as long as I know exactly what's in queue, I just take the average setup and process times for each type of part, and I'm able to calculate when each batch should clear the bottleneck. Because we're only dealing with one work center with much less dependency, we can average the statistical fluctuations and get a better degree of accuracy. Now, I know from observation it takes about 2 weeks, plus or minus a day or two, for material to reach the bottlenecks from the first operations. So by adding 2 weeks to the setup and process times of what's in queue at the bottleneck, I know how long it will take until the bottleneck is actually working on material we release. and as each batch leaves the bottleneck, we can update our information and calculate a date when Stacy should release more red tag material.
That's excellent.
Ralph, that's terrific. How accurate do you really think we can be with this?
I'd say we'd be accurate to within plus or minus a day. So if we keep, say, a three-day stock of work in process in front of each bottleneck, we should be safe.
But in fact, Ralph, you can do much more than that with the same information.
Like what?
You can also attack the inventory problems in front of assembly.
You mean we not only can do something about excess inventory on the bottleneck parts, but on the non-bottleneck parts as well?
Exactly.
Sorry, folks. I'm not sure how I'd do that.
Now, if Ralph can determine a schedule for releasing red tag materials based on the bottlenecks, he can also determine a schedule for final assembly. Once he knows when the bottleneck parts will reach final assembly, he can calculate backwards and determine the release of the non-bottleneck materials along each of their routes. In this way, the bottlenecks will be determining the release of all the materials in the plant.
You know, that's going to produce the same effect as moving the bottlenecks to the head of production, which is what I had intended for us to do.
Yeah, it sounds good. But I have to warn you, I can't say how long it'll take before I can make the computer do all that. I mean, I can have a schedule for the red tag materials worked out in fairly short order. The rest of it will take a while.
Ah, come on, Ralphie. Computer whiz like you ought to be able to crank that out in no time.
I can crank something out in no time, but I'm not going to promise it'll work.
Relax. As long as we ease the load on the milling machines, we'll be okay for the short haul. That'll give you the time to get something basic in place.
Hey, you may feel you have the time now to relax. I have to catch a plane for Chicago in 35 minutes.
Oh, shit. I guess we better move. It was not a graceful parting. Jonah and I ran out of the building, and I broke numerous speed limits without incident getting him to the airport.
I have, shall we say, a special interest in plants like yours. So I'd appreciate it if you'd keep me informed of what happened.
Sure, no problem. In fact, I'd planned on it.
Good. I'll be talking to you.
And with that, he was out of the car and with a wave was sprinting through the terminal doors. I didn't get a call, so I suppose he made it. When I go to work the next morning, we have a meeting about how to implement this approach. But before we can get down to talking about it, Bob Donovan starts waving a red flag at us.
You know, we could be walking into a big problem.
What's that?
What happens if efficiencies all over the plant go down?
Well, I think that's a risk we'll have to take.
Yeah. But it sounds like we're going to have a lot of people idle around here if we do this.
Yeah, we might have some people idle from time to time.
So are we just supposed to let everyone stand around out there?
Why not? Once the somebody is already on the payroll, it doesn't cost us any more to have him be idle. Whether somebody produces parts or waits a few minutes doesn't increase our operating expense. But excess inventory? Now that ties up a lot of money.
Okay, but what about the reporting system? Seems to me that at the end of the month, when old Bill Peach is ready to decide if we stay open or if we close down, he's not going to be awful positive about us if he sees our efficiencies have taken a dive. I hear they do tend to frown upon that at headquarters.
He does have a point, Al.
All right, look. If we don't go ahead with a system to withhold inventory and release it according to the bottlenecks, we'll be missing a major opportunity to improve performance and save the plant. And I'm not about to stand by and let that happen just to maintain a standard that obviously has more impact on middle management politics than it does on the bottom line. I say we go ahead with this, and if efficiencies drop, let them. After those brave words, so reminiscent of Admiral Farragut in his Damn the Torpedo speech, the others are a little misty-eyed. And, Bob, if there is a lot of idle time out there, don't hassle anybody. Just make damn sure it doesn't show up in the efficiency reports next month, okay?
Gotcha, boss.
Chapter 27.
Let me say in conclusion that had it not been for the increase in revenue generated last month by the Barrington plant and its products, the Uniware division's losses would have continued for the seventh consecutive month. All of the other manufacturing operations in the division reported only marginal gains in performance or sustained losses. Despite the improvement at Barrington and the fact that as a result the division recorded its first operating profit of this year, we have a long way to go before we are back on solid financial footing.
Having said that, Ethan Frost gets the nod from Bill Peach and sits down. I'm sitting halfway down a long table where all the plant managers are gathered. On Peach's right is Hilton Smythe, who happens to be glowering at me in the aftermath of Frost's tribute to my plant. I relax in my chair and for a moment allow myself to contemplate the view through the broad plate glass window, a sunny city on an early summer day. May has ended. Aside from the problem with the shortages of non-bottleneck parts, which have now gone away, it's been an excellent month. We're now timing the release of all materials according to a new system Ralph Nakamura developed, which is keyed to the speed of the bottlenecks. He's got a data terminal now at both of the bottlenecks, so as inventory is processed, the latest information can be fed directly into the plant database. With the new system, we're beginning to see excellent results. Ralph did a little experimenting with the system and soon discovered we can predict within a day, more or less, when a shipment will leave the plant. Based on this, we've been able to put together a report to marketing listing all customer orders and dates when they will be shipped. I don't know if anybody in marketing really believes that report, but so far, it's been highly accurate.
Rogo, because you seem to be the only one among us who has improved to any degree, we'll let you start the round of reports.
I open up the cover of my report and launch into a presentation of the highlights. By almost every standard, we've had a good month. Inventory levels have fallen and are continuing to fall rapidly. Withholding some materials has meant we're no longer choking on work in process. Parts are reaching the bottlenecks when they're supposed to, and the flow through the plant is much smoother than before. And what happened to efficiencies? Well, they did fall initially, as we began to withhold raw material from the floor, but not as much as we'd been afraid they would. It turns out we were consuming excess inventory. But with the rate of shipments up dramatically, that excess has melted quickly, and now that we're beginning to resume releases of materials to non-bottlenecks again, efficiencies are on their way back up. Donovan has even told me confidentially he thinks the real numbers in the future will be almost the same as before. The best news is we've wiped out our backlog of overdue orders. Amazing as it seems, we're completely caught up. So customer service has improved. Throughput is up. We're on our way back. It's too bad the standard report we've prepared can't begin to tell the full story of what's really going on. When I've finished, I look up the table and see Hilton Smythe whispering something to Bill Peach. There's quiet around the table for a moment. Then Bill nods to Hilton and talks to me.
Good job, Al.
Through with me, Bill asks another manager to deliver his report. I sit back, irritated slightly that Peach wasn't more positive, that he didn't put more praise on me the way Frost had indicated he should. I came in here feeling as though we'd really turned the plant around, and I guess I expected a little more than a good job pat on the head. But then I have to remind myself that Peach doesn't know the extent of the change. Should he know? Should we be telling him? Lou has asked me about this, and I've told him, no, let's hold off for a while. We could go to Bill Peach and make a presentation to him, put all our cards on the table, and let him decide. In fact, that's exactly what we will do eventually, but not yet. And I think I have a good reason. I've worked with Bill Peach for a lot of years. I know him pretty well. He's a smart man, but he's not an innovator. A couple of years ago, he might have let us run with this for a while. Not today. I have a feeling if we go to him now, he'll put on his hard nose and tell me to run the plant by the cost accounting methods he believes in. I have to bide my time until I can go to him with a solid case that my way, Jonah's way, really, is the one that truly works. It's too early for that. We've broken too many rules to tell him the full story now. But will we have the time? That's what I keep asking myself. Peach hasn't voluntarily lifted the threat to close the plant. I thought he might say something, publicly or privately, after this report. But he hasn't. I look at him at the end of the table. He seems distracted, not like himself. The others talk, and he seems only half interested. Hilton seems to cue him on what to say. What's with him? The meeting breaks up about an hour after lunch. And by then, I've decided to have a private talk with Peach, if I can get it. I follow him out into the corridor from the conference room and ask him. He invites me into his office. So, when are you going to let us off the hook? Bill sits down in a big, upholstered chair, and I take the one opposite him. Without the desk between us, it's a nice little intimate chat.
What makes you think I'm going to?
Barrington's on its way back. We can make that plant make money for the division.
Can you? Look, Al, you've had a good month. That's a step in the right direction, but can you give us a second good month and a third and a fourth? That's what I'm waiting for.
We'll give them to you.
I'm going to be frank. I'm not yet convinced that this hasn't been just a flash in the pan, so to speak. You had a huge overdue backlog. It was inevitable you'd ship it eventually. What have you done to reduce cost? Nothing that I can see. It's going to take a 10 or 15% reduction in operating expense to make the plant profitable for the long term.
I feel my heart sink. Bill, if next month we turn in another improvement, will you at least delay the recommendation to close the plant?
It'll have to be a bigger improvement than what you gave us in this past period.
How big?
Just give me 15% more on the bottom line than you did this month.
I think we can do that. I note the split second of shock blink into Peach's face.
Fine. If you can deliver that and keep delivering it, we'll keep Barrington open.
If I do this for you, I'm thinking, you'd be an idiot to close us. Peach stands, our chat concluded. I fly the Buick up the entrance ramp to the interstate with the accelerator floored and the radio turned up loud. The adrenaline is pumping. The thoughts in my head are racing faster than the car. 2 months ago, I figured I might be sending out my resume by now. But Peach just said if we turned in another good month, he'd let the plant stay open. We're almost there. We just might be able to pull this off. Just one more month. But 15%? We've been eating up our backlog of orders at a terrific rate. And by doing so, we've been able to ship a tremendous volume of product. Tremendous by any comparison. Last month, last quarter, last year. It's given us a big surge of income, and it's looked fantastic on the books. But now that we've shipped all the overdues, and we're putting out new orders much faster than before, the thought creeps up on me that I'm in really big trouble. Where the hell am I going to get the orders that will give me an extra 15%? Peach isn't just asking for another good month. He's demanding an incredible month. He hasn't promised anything. I have, and probably too much. I'm trying to remember the orders scheduled for the coming weeks and attempting to calculate in my head if we're going to have the volume of business necessary for the bottom line increase Peach wants to see. I have a scary feeling it won't be enough. Okay, I can ship ahead of schedule. I can take the orders scheduled for the first week or two of July and ship them in June instead. But what am I going to do after that? I'm going to be putting us into a huge hole in which we have nothing else to do. We need more business. I wonder where Jonah is these days. Glancing down at the speedometer, I find to my surprise that I'm zipping along at 80. I slow down. I loosen my tie. No sense killing myself trying to get back to the plant. It occurs to me, in fact, that by the time I get back to the plant, it'll be time to go home. Just about then, I pass a sign saying I'm 2 miles from the interchange that would put me on the highway to Forest Grove. Well, why not? I haven't seen Julie or the kids in a couple of days. Since the end of school, the kids have been staying with Julie and her parents. I take the interchange and get off at the next exit. At a gas station on the corner, I find a payphone and make a call to the office. Fran answers, and I tell her two things. First, pass the word to Bob, Stacy, Ralph, and Lou that the meeting went well for us. And second, I tell her not to expect me to come in this afternoon. When I get to the Barnett's house, I get a nice welcome. I spend quite a while just talking to Sharon and Dave. Then Julie suggests we go for a walk together. It's a fine summer afternoon outside. As I'm hugging Sharon to say goodbye, she whispers in my ear,
Daddy, when are we all going to go home together?
Real soon, I hope. Despite the assurance I gave her, Sharon's question doesn't go away. I've been wondering the same thing myself. Julie and I go to the park, and after walking for a while, we sit down on a bench by the river. We sit without saying anything for a while. She asks me if something is wrong. I tell her about Sharon's question.
She asks me that all the time.
She does? What do you tell her?
I tell her we'll be going home real soon.
That's what I said to her. Do you really mean that?
You've been a lot of fun to be around in the last few weeks.
Thanks. The feeling is mutual.
But I'm sorry, Al. I'm still worried about coming home.
Why? We're getting along a lot better now. What's the problem?
Look, we've had some good times for a change. And that's fine. I've really needed this time with you. But if we go back to living together, you know what's going to happen, don't you? Everything will be fine for about 2 days. But a week from now, we'll be having the same arguments. And a month later, or 6 months, or a year from now, well, you know what I mean.
Julie, Was it that bad living with me?
Al, it wasn't bad. It was just... I don't know. You weren't paying any attention to me.
But I was having all kinds of problems in my job. I was really in over my head for a while. What did you expect from me?
More than what I was getting. You know, when I was growing up, my father always came home from work at the same time. The whole family always ate together. He spent the evenings at home. With you, I never know what's going on.
You can't compare me to your father. He's a dentist. After the last tooth of the day is filled, he can lock up and go home. My business isn't like that.
Alex, the problem is you are not like that. Other people go to work and come home at regular times.
Yes, you're partially right. I am not like other people. When I get involved in something, I really get involved. And maybe that has to do with the way I was brought up. Look at my family. We hardly ever ate together. Somebody always had to be minding the store. It was my father's rule. The business was what fed us, so it came first. We all understood that, and we all worked together.
So what does that prove, except our families were different? I'm telling you about something that bothered me so much and for so long that I wasn't even sure if I loved you anymore.
So what makes you sure you love me now?
Do you want another fight?
No, I don't want a fight.
You see, nothing has changed, has it?
Neither of us says a word for quite a while. Julie gets up and walks over to the river. It looks for a second as if she might run away. She doesn't. She comes back again and sits down on the bench.
When I was 18, I had everything planned. College, a teaching degree, marriage, a house, children. In that order. All the decisions were made. I knew what china pattern I wanted. I knew the names I wanted for the kids. I knew what the house should look like and what color the rug should be. Everything was certain. And it was so important that I have it all. But now, I have it all, only it's different somehow. None of it seems to matter.
Julie, why does your life have to conform to this perfect image you have in your head? Do you even know why you want the things you do?
Because that's how I grew up. And what about you? Why do you have to have this big career? Why do you feel compelled to work 24 hours a day? I'm sorry. I'm just very confused.
No, that's okay. It was a good question. I have no idea why I wouldn't be satisfied being a grocer or a 9-to-5 office worker.
Al, why don't we just try to forget all this?
No, I don't think so. I think we should do the opposite. We ought to start asking a few more questions.
Like what?
Like, what is our marriage supposed to do for us? My idea of the goal of a marriage is not living in a perfect house where everything happens according to a clock. Is that the goal for you?
All I'm asking for is a little dependability from my husband. And what's all this about a goal? When you're married, you're just married. There is no goal.
Then why be married?
You get married because of commitment, because of love, because of all the reasons everybody else does. Alex, you're asking a lot of dumb questions.
Whether they're dumb or smart, I'm asking them because we've been living together for 15 years, and we have no clear understanding of what our marriage is supposed to do, or become, or anything. We're just coasting along, doing what everyone else does. And it turns out the two of us have some very different assumptions of what our lives are supposed to be like.
My parents have been married for 37 years, and they never asked any questions. Nobody ever asks what is the goal of a marriage. People just get married because they're in love.
Oh, well, that explains everything, doesn't it?
Al, please don't ask these questions. They don't have any answers. And if we keep talking this way, we're going to ruin everything. If this is your way of saying you're having second thoughts about us...
Julie, I'm not having second thoughts about you. But you're the one who can't figure out what's wrong with us. Maybe if you tried to think about this logically instead of simply comparing us to the characters in a romance novel...
I do not read romance novels.
Then where did you get your ideas about how a marriage is supposed to be? Look, all I'm saying is we ought to throw away, for the moment, all the preconceptions we have about our marriage and just take a look at how we are right now. Then we ought to figure out what we want to have happen and go in that direction. But Julie doesn't seem to be listening. She stands up.
I think it's time we walked back.
On the way back to the Barnett house, we're as silent as two icebergs in January, the two of us drifting together. I look at one side of the street. Julie looks at the opposite. When we walk through the door, Mrs. Barnett invites me to stay for dinner, but I say I've got to be going. I say goodbye to the kids, give Julie a wave, and leave. I'm getting into the Buick when I hear her come running after me.
Will I see you again on Saturday?
Yeah, sure. Sounds good.
I'm sorry about what happened.
I guess we'll just have to keep trying until we get it right. We both start smiling. Then we do some of that nice stuff that makes an argument almost worth the agony.
Chapter 28.
I get home just as the sun is starting to set. The sky is rosy pink. As I'm unlocking the kitchen door, I hear the phone ringing inside. I rush in to grab it.
Good morning.
Morning. I'm watching the sun set. Where are you calling from?
Singapore.
Oh, by the way,
for my hotel, I'm watching the sun rise. Alex, I wouldn't have called you at home, but I'm not going to be able to talk to you again for a few weeks.
Why not?
Well, it's a long story, and I can't go into it now. But I'm sure we'll have a chance to discuss it sometime.
I see. That's too bad. It puts me in a kind of a bind, because I was just about to ask for your help again.
Has something gone wrong?
Nah. Everything's generally going very well from an operations standpoint, but I just had a meeting with my division vice president, and I was told that the plant has to show an even bigger improvement.
You're still not making money?
Yes, we're making money again, but we need to accelerate the improvement to save the plant from being shut down.
If I were you, I wouldn't worry too much about being shut down.
Well, from what the head of the division has told me, the possibility of a shutdown is real. And until he says otherwise, I can't afford to take it lightly.
Alex, if you want to improve the plant even more, I'm with you all the way. And since I won't have the opportunity to speak with you for a while, let's talk about it now. Bring me up to date on what's happening.
So I do. Then, wondering if we've reached some theoretical limit by now, I ask him if there's anything else we can try.
Anything else? Believe me, we have only begun. Now, here is what I suggest.
Early the next morning, I'm in my office at the plant considering what Jonah told me. Outside is the dawn of the day he's already seen in Singapore. Stepping out to get a cup of coffee, I find Stacy at the coffee machine.
Hello there. I hear everything went fairly well for us at headquarters yesterday.
Well, not bad. I'm afraid we still have a long way to go before we convince Peach we're good for the long term. But I talked to Jonah last night.
Did you tell him about our progress?
Yeah, and he suggested we try what he called the next logical step.
What's that?
Cut our batch sizes in half on non-bottlenecks.
But why?
Because in the end, we'll make more money.
I don't understand. How is that going to help us?
Hey, Stacy, you're in charge of inventory control. You tell me what would happen if we cut our batch sizes in half. Thinking, she sips her coffee for a moment. Her brow compresses in concentration.
If we cut our batch sizes in half, then I guess that at any one time we'd have half the work in process on the floor. I guess that means we'd only need half the investment in work in process to keep the plant working. If we could work it out with our vendors, we could conceivably cut all our inventories in half. And by cutting our inventories in half, we reduce the amount of cash tied up at any one time, which eases the pressure on cash flow.
I'm nodding each time she says a sentence. That's right. That's one set of benefits.
But to reap those benefits fully, we'd have to have our suppliers increase the frequency of deliveries to us and reduce the quantity of each delivery. That's going to take some negotiating through purchasing, and I'm not sure all the vendors will go for it.
That's something we can work on. Eventually, they'll go for it, because it's to their advantage as well as ours.
But if we go to smaller batch sizes, doesn't that mean we'll have to have more setups on equipment?
Sure, don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
But Donovan
will
say that...
will do just fine, even with more setups. And meanwhile, there's another set of benefits, aside from what you said, that we can have almost immediately.
What's that?
You really want to know?
Sure, I do.
Good. You set up a meeting with the other functions, and I'll tell everyone at the same time. For dumping that little chore of the meeting arrangements on her, Stacy pays me back in kind by setting the meeting for noon at the most expensive restaurant in town, with lunch billable to my expense number, of course.
What could I do? It was the only time everybody was available, right, Bob?
Right.
I'm not mad. Given the quality and quantity of work these people have done recently, I can't complain about picking up the tab for lunch.
I get right down to telling everybody what Stacy and I had talked about this morning and lead up to the other set of benefits. Part of what Jonah told me last night over the phone had to do with the time a piece of material spends inside a plant. If you consider the total time from the moment the material comes into the plant to the minute it goes out the door as part of a finished product, you can divide that time into four elements. One of them is setup, the time the part spends waiting for a resource, while the resource is preparing itself to work on the part. Another is process time, which is the amount of time the part spends being modified into a new, more valuable form. A third element is queue time, which is the time the part spends in line for a resource while the resource is busy working on something else ahead of it. The fourth element is wait time, which is the time the part waits, not for a resource, but for another part so they can be assembled together. As Jonah pointed out last night, setup and process are a small portion of the total elapsed time for any part. But queue and wait often consume large amounts of time. In fact, the majority of the elapsed total that the part spends inside the plant. For parts that are going through bottlenecks, queue is the dominant portion. The part is stuck in front of the bottleneck for a long time. For parts that are only going through non-bottlenecks, wait is dominant, because they are waiting in front of assembly for parts that are coming from the bottlenecks, which means that in each case, the bottlenecks are what dictate this elapsed time, which in turn means the bottlenecks dictate inventory as well as throughput. We've been setting batch sizes according to an economical batch quantity, or EBQ, formula. Last night, Jonah told me that although he didn't have time over the phone to go into all the reasons, EBQ has a number of flawed assumptions underlying it. Instead, he asked me to consider what would happen if we cut batch sizes by half from their present quantities. If we reduce batch sizes by half, we also reduce by half the time it will take to process a batch. That means we reduce queue and wait by half as well. Reduce those by half, and we reduce by about half the total time parts spend in the plant. Reduce the time parts spend in the plant, and our total lead time condenses. And with less time spent sitting in a pile, the speed of the flow of parts increases.
And with faster turnaround on orders, customers get their orders faster.
Not only that, but with shorter lead times, we can respond faster.
That's right. If we can respond to the market faster, we get an advantage in the marketplace.
That means more customers come to us because we can deliver faster.
Our sales increase.
And so do our bonuses.
Whoa, now hold up here a minute.
What's the matter?
What about setup time? You cut batch sizes in half, you double the number of setups. What about direct labor? We gotta save on setups to keep down costs.
Okay, I knew this would come up. Now look, it's time we think about this carefully. Jonah told me last night that there was a corresponding rule to the one about an hour lost at a bottleneck. You remember that? An hour lost at a bottleneck is an hour lost for the entire system.
Yeah, I remember.
The rule he gave me last night is that an hour saved at a non-bottleneck is a mirage.
A mirage? What do you mean an hour saved at a non-bottleneck is a mirage? An hour saved is an hour saved.
No, it isn't. Since we began withholding materials from the floor until the bottlenecks are ready for them, the non-bottlenecks now have idle time. It's perfectly okay to have more setups on non-bottlenecks, because all we're doing is cutting into time the machines would spend being idle. Saving setups at a non-bottleneck doesn't make the system one bit more productive. The time and money saved is an illusion. Even if we double the number of setups, it won't consume all the idle time.
Okay. I guess I can see what you mean.
Now, Jonas said, first of all, to cut the batch sizes in half. Then he suggested I go immediately to marketing and convince them to conduct a new campaign which will promise customers earlier deliveries.
Can we do it?
Already, our lead times have condensed considerably over what they were before thanks to the priority system and making the bottlenecks more productive. We've reduced lead time of about 3 to 4 months down to 2 months or even less. If we cut our batch sizes in half, how fast do you think we can respond? There's an eternity of hemming and hawing while this is debated.
Okay, if we cut batch sizes in half, then that means it ought to take half the time it does now. So, instead of 6 to 8 weeks, it should take about 4 weeks. Maybe even 3 weeks in a lot of cases.
Suppose I go to marketing and tell them to promise customers deliveries in 3 weeks.
Oh, whoa, hold on.
Yeah, give us a break.
All right, 4 weeks then. That's reasonable, isn't it?
Sounds reasonable to me.
Well, okay.
I think we should risk it.
So, are you willing to commit to this with us?
Well, I'm all for bigger bonuses. What the hell? Let's try it.
Friday morning finds the Buick and me again hustling up the interstate toward headquarters. I hit town just as the sun hits the glass of the Unico building and reflects a blinding glare. Kind of pretty, actually. For a moment, it takes my mind off my nerves. I've got a meeting scheduled with Johnny Johns in his office. When I called, he was quite willing to see me, but sounded less than enthusiastic about what I said I'd like to talk about. I feel there's a lot riding on my ability to convince him to go along with what we want to do, so I found myself biting a fingernail or two during the trip. Johns doesn't really have a desk in his office. He's got a sheet of glass on chrome legs. I guess that's so everyone can get a good look at his Gucci loafers and silk socks, which he exposes as he leans back in this chair, interweaves his fingers, and puts them behind his head.
So, how's everything going?
Everything's going very well right now. In fact, that's why I wanted to talk to you. Johns immediately dons an impassive face. All right, listen, I'm going to lay my cards out for you. I'm not exaggerating when I say everything is going well. It is. We've worked off our backlog of overdue orders, as you know. At the beginning of last week, the plant began producing strictly to meet projected due dates.
Yes, I've noticed my phone hasn't been ringing lately with complaints from customers missing their orders.
My point is that we've really turned the plant around. Here, look at this. From my briefcase, I take the latest computer-generated list of customer orders. Among other things, it shows the due dates promised, along with the dates when Ralph expected shipment, and the dates the products were actually shipped. You see,